well as Winston Flames, Jarrett, and DJ Zacto for this holiday concert. Again, that's Vintage Ska and Rock Steady with Keith and Tex on Saturday, December 22nd from 9 to 11:30 p.m. at the Jack London Review, 529 Southwest 4th Avenue in Portland. This is a 21 and over event. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is requesting proposals for a grant writer to provide ongoing grant writing services and application support. This is a one-year contract position for 200 hours, compensated at $25 an hour. Proposals must be submitted electronically to Delphine Crescenzo, station manager at Dell, that's D-E-L, at kbu.fm. Proposals are due Friday, January 4th at 5 p.m. Responsibilities, background information, the scope of work, and proposal requirements can be found at kbu.fm/grantwriter2018.
Welcome to The Food Show. My name is Emily Becker.
And I'm Tal Caspi. We're the hosts of The Food Show. Today we're talking about holiday food traditions. We'll hear stories about holidays and ice cream from Jared Goodman of Morgan Street Theater, talk to Nikki Brown about celebrating Kwanzaa, and wrap up by speaking with Johnny Shaver about the Emergency Shelter Network.
Before we get started, we want to share a little bit about ourselves. This is our first show as co-hosts. For the past 4 years, Chris Siegel has been the host, but he recently left Portland. Before he left, my good friend Roselle Medina ran into Chris and suggested that I would be a great new host for The Food Show. Thanks, Roselle. Then, Tal, I told you about the show, and you got so excited. And now we're co-hosting. So, Tal, what made you want to do the show?
I've just always wanted to be on the radio, and I love food. So it's the perfect combination.
It is. Well, I'm thrilled to have you as co-host because you're a chef and a restaurant owner. So you'll bring those unique perspectives to the show. Tell us about your restaurant, Aviv.
Yes, I have a restaurant on 12th and Division. It is a vegan Middle Eastern restaurant. Also have a packaged hummus company. And we're about to launch a vegan ice cream company into new seasons in January.
Ah, cool. What made you want to make Middle Eastern food?
I'm from Israel and I miss the food. And there's no vegan Israeli food that I've ever heard of in the area, so I did it.
That's awesome. Well, I'm super excited to be hosting this show with you. And I've got one more question. This, our show's about holiday traditions. What's your favorite holiday tradition?
I love any holiday that has anything to do with food. So my tradition is to just get together with friends and cook. And what is yours?
Well, my favorite holiday in the winter is my birthday, which is in January, January 9th.
Is that a holiday?
Absolutely. It's definitely a holiday. But I try not to do anything year over. I like to do something different every year. When I was a kid, we definitely celebrated Christmas in very average, normal ways. And then it kind of devolved into my sister and I just fighting over who got to put the angel on top of the Christmas tree, whose turn it was. And then, like, not letting my dad ever finish reading A Night Before Christmas. We just interrupt and be like, why is Santa wearing fur? That's not cool. And then as I got older, I really kind of just let go of all those traditions. I don't really celebrate any of those holidays anymore. And I've felt really good about that for a long time. But I had an interesting conversation with Jared Goodman yesterday, and it made me rethink the value of holiday traditions and the kind of specialness and the ritual and all that brings into people's lives. I talked to Jared yesterday, and he has this ice cream and storytelling pop-up called Morgan Street Theater.
That sounds like fun.
It sounds really fun. I want to go sometime. He brings people together at his house. It's on Morgan Street, hence Morgan Street Theater, and now at other locations around town too. And he shares stories and food. And in addition to Morgan Street Theater, he's worked with the Portland Art Museum, and he just wrapped up the first iteration of the Jewish Project. And in that project, he tells personal stories of being Jewish, weaving in Jewish history and culture. And each story is paired with a handmade ice cream dessert that's inspired by the story. I started by asking Jared to describe the origins of his ice cream events.
Morgan Street Theater started as a way to be with more adults. I've been a stay-at-home dad for 6.5 years. And when my daughter was a little over one, and I was really feeling the isolation of being a stay-at-home parent, I had this idea, perhaps influenced by marijuana, that I could revolutionize the ice cream sundae by making it smaller and more thoughtfully composed. Now, I did not know at that time that there were pastry chefs already doing that at fancy restaurants, mm-hmm. though the idea here was to have like a tasting menu of ice cream desserts that get increasingly sweeter, so they're not all like super sweet. And they're small portion sizes. At first it was friends and friends of friends, but pretty quickly it became people I don't know. Mm-hmm. And I would provide a tasting menu of ice cream desserts. And Becky, who's my partner, she said, you know, you really love telling stories. Why don't you also do, I mean, they're already here. Mm-hmm. May as well include stories in it. So I did. And then it became storytelling and ice cream. Actually, the story that I was thinking of telling today was one of the first stories I told, because I started doing Morgan Street Theater in October. And the October and November, I just kind of made desserts. And then December was, I think, the first time where I was like, oh, I'm going to try and tell stories. So the theme for Morgan Street Theater, the menu is driven by a theme and what's in season. And in December, I think Game of Thrones was also quite popular at the time. The theme I wanted was called Winter is Coming. And there were three wintry December theme-based stories. I grew up with a deep resentment of Christmas. I'm Jewish. I don't celebrate Christmas. Well, at the time I didn't when I was a young person. And being told Merry Christmas all the time by everyone around you, teachers, people at the bank, people at the grocery store, people walking their dogs down the street, bombarding you with Merry Christmases all the time. It really made me mad as a young person. And the music everywhere and the lights and the kind of like this monolithic cultural pressure. I don't know how the visual, just like the bearing down of Christmas. And I don't celebrate Christmas. And it always made me really angry to be like, tell me, I remember even people would say Merry Christmas to me and I would say Happy Hanukkah to them. And they'd say, I don't celebrate Hanukkah. And they'd say, I don't celebrate Christmas. And for me, again, as a Jewish person, because I didn't celebrate it, my relationship to or my exposure to Christmas was popular culture and like the world around me. So it's like the incessant holiday music that's in all the stores or restaurants, but it's also the same like Christmas movies that would come on TV every year. So in my mind, everybody celebrated Christmas and their Christmas experience was all the same. And it was years later, I fell in love with a non-Jewish woman and eventually got married, and I started doing Christmas with her family. And it was the first time I'd ever done Christmas. And something dawned on me that completely shifted my, it removed my resentment and it kind of turned it into love or appreciation. Because by doing Christmas with my wife's family, I learned for the first time that each family has their own traditions. You know, whatever it might be that makes it their own Christmas. And in my wife's family, her dad grew up in upstate New York, and his family had this like inn. And every year for Christmas Eve, his dad, who was the chef at this inn, wouldn't be home. He'd be working. But he would make this huge vat of like chow mein. That's what they call it, chow mein. Which, again, it's a Jewish person. We ate Chinese food on Christmas, which is a stereotype that we fulfilled. But Becky's dad ate chow mein on Christmas Eve, and that was like his tradition. At this restaurant that his father had at the inn, they were really famous for this bread that they served, not only during Christmas, but year-round, called Sally Lunn bread. I think as her dad got older and, you know, left his town, Sally Lunn bread became this like Christmas bread that they'd only make during Christmas. So I loved that, again, to go back to, as a Jewish person, there are so many food traditions for a variety of holidays. You know, the one that's the most common is Shabbat. And so on Shabbat, it's the only time of the week where you eat challah, which is a sweet braided egg bread. And so this idea that once a year on Christmas you make the Sally Lunn bread, giving it that same like sacredness and specialness, because this is the only time in the year where we're going to have it. I really related to that, and I loved it. I've now been with my wife now for over 10 years, and I've done many Christmases, and I look forward to it every year, and I love it.
And do you make the bread?
I have. I mean, I help make the chow mein, or I'll help my wife's mom. She makes this coffee cake, which I think is a little more common, like a coffee cake that's filled with like cinnamon sugar, and it's rolled up, and it's yeasted, and they make that, you know. And like there's just like all of the procedures to even prepare for Christmas, taking out the ornaments, putting them on the tree, putting out the stockings, you know. As a young person, not having never been to someone's house for Christmas, I didn't know all these things, and I didn't get it, and I didn't appreciate these like almost sub-traditions for each individual family. And now that I have it with my wife's family, I almost want to go to other people's houses for Christmas to see what they're doing and to see how it's different. So I made a dessert to capture a variety of things in the story. So the dessert that I had made at the time, I made the Sally Lunn bread. I got the recipe from my father-in-law. And I made Sally Lunn bread, and it was like cut into a circle, and I toasted it. And on top was white chocolate ice cream. And it was sitting in this pool, small pool, of olive oil. And then in the olive oil, I had this raspberry vinegar that I make. So you have white, red, and green, which are just like the boringest of Christmas colors in my mind. At the same time, so I wanted a dessert that like looked like but then like the flavors really pop, because finding out that the uniqueness of each individual Christmas is what really makes Christmas special. And so, and being able to have a component of the dessert be this family recipe that's done on Christmas. So yeah, so that's an example of the ice cream based desserts that are inspired by the performance pieces. So rather than just being like, this is the menu and this is the art and they're two separate things, mm-hmm. there's an intentional correlation between the dessert and the performance. So much so that it's as if the dessert is another way of thinking about or experiencing the story. I like the idea that there's a multitude of ways to understand there's no singular definition or there's no singular meaning to something.
Yeah.
And so the dessert piece just allows there to be another interpretation that you can eat.
A delicious interpretation.
A delicious interpretation, yes.
Do you have a favorite holiday?
Like Jewish or not Jewish?
Mm-hmm.
Well, Shabbat is my favorite Jewish holiday because it's every week. And it's, for me, it's based around this meal on Friday night. And the whole premise for Shabbat is to take a break from the constantness of our lives and to recharge your spirit for the week ahead. And, you know, if you're a traditional person, that could be like, you know, going to synagogue and praying and participating in like traditional rituals. And I'm not in that position. I really just like having the Shabbat dinner with my family and friends every Friday night, or most Friday nights. And in that sense, it's like making something special. I think just, it feels good to have specialness in your life. And why have something special once a year? Why not have it every week? Everybody loves it. It feels really good. So that's why it's my favorite holiday, I think.
So what's the project that you're working on now?
This last year, I received a grant from the Regional Arts and Culture Council, mm-hmm. known as RAC, to create the Jewish Project. Is a Morgan Street Theater show of ice cream and storytelling. And the ice cream desserts are inspired by the stories, and the stories are inspired by Jewish history and culture. And I hosted 6 events all over Portland in 6 different venues. And it was like wildly successful. It sold out before I had done the second show. And it was kind of the biggest project I had done with Morgan Street Theater yet. The stories are very personal and very vulnerable. And I've been really inspired that I put my heart out there and that people came and listened and enjoyed themselves. So I'm currently planning another run of that show in 2019.
Why did you pick ice cream as your medium for this work that you're doing?
It was a strategic reasoning because at the time, I mean, it would still be the same reason now, I think. Portland is saturated, overly saturated with phenomenal chefs who make, for the most part, dinners and lunches. So I knew that if I wanted to make savory food, I mean, I couldn't compete. The ice cream, as far as, I've always loved making desserts. I've always been into baking. I knew I wanted to do dessert just because I didn't feel like there was like as many super interesting and unique desserts happening in Portland as there was dinners. So I thought that was just a way to carve out a niche. At the time when I started Morgan Street Theater, I'd been making ice cream for several years at home, and it was just a medium that I wanted to kind of get into. What I've come to realize now after all these years is that ice cream is so nostalgic for people, and it makes people so happy. I mean, it really brings out like this inner child giving someone some ice cream, whether it's in a cone or a cup. And ice cream socials are not a new idea. So having a group of people sitting together eating ice cream and listening to stories, it seems like this really unique Portlandia thing, but to me it seems very obvious, like people getting together, sharing a dessert, and telling stories with each other. I mean, that's how I like to be with my friends. So mm-hmm. I guess I just wanted to impose that on people. But yeah, it wasn't because, you know, ice cream has this inherent ness. There's nothing really deep about it. It's just that I think ice cream puts people at ease and makes them feel comfortable, makes them feel childish. And it was just a dessert medium that I wanted to experiment with. Here's something about the ice cream. Why ice cream and not other things? Before Morgan Street Theater, before being a stay-at-home dad, I was a high school social studies teacher, and I was a food blogger about food politics. I was deeply interested in that stuff. And I came to believe that ice cream would be a really great vehicle to talk about sustainability, from talking about small dairies versus industrial dairies, to grass-fed cows versus grain-fed cows, the quality of the milk and the fat in the milk from how a cow lives, and so forth, to let alone talking about like using seasonal ingredients and sourcing from small farms. And
Well, Jared, thank you so much for joining the food show today. Where can people find out more about you and eat your delicious ice cream and experience your stories?
Well, I'm so happy you asked that question. Unlike every other food business in town, you can only find me if you know where I am. And to know where I am, you probably want to be on the mailing list. So you can go to morganstreettheater.com, and to spell that out, it's morganstheater.com, to join the mailing list or to get tickets for upcoming events. I'm also on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter, although mostly Facebook and Instagram, with the handle at Morgan Street Theater.
You're listening to The Food Show. We're talking about holiday food traditions today. Next up, we've got Nikki Brown on the phone. Nikki grew up in North Portland and became the first black clown in Portland in 2011 for the Juneteenth Parade. Since then, she's been active in the clown community and works to promote cultural pride and awareness in the black community. With a special focus on engaging children of diverse backgrounds, Nikki Brown promotes literacy, reading, healthy eating, and cooking. Nikki currently lives in Northern California, but is still active in Portland, and was honored with a mural in the heart of Northeast Portland. Welcome to the Food Show, Nikki.
Hey. Hello, everybody.
Hi, Nikki.
Hi. Thank you for having me on today.
Thanks for being on. First of all, what was it like being a clown in Portland?
Oh, my goodness. Okay. being a clown in Portland was absolutely fabulous, but for most Portlanders, because it is so weird and quirky, nobody really at first paid me any mind, but it was really my brown skin that got my name, Nikki Brown Clown, and that set me apart. So everybody started to take notice, like, whoa, who is this brown clown driving around? So just really, really fun.
What made you want to be a clown in the first place?
Oh, you know, I'm going to be honest with you. Growing up in Portland, I just knew something was missing. After graduating from high school and whatnot, I started a career in early childhood. And I just always thought something was missing. I wanted to be a teacher, but I didn't successfully finish school. But, you know, I'm just going to be honest with you. And I just said, you know, somebody ought to do something about that. And then that's when I realized it was me. And, you know, I just realized that was going to be the platform. But honestly, it really just all started at being asked by my auntie, who asked me to come out for the celebration. And she had remembered a time I came to the block party. rest in peace, Auntie Doris. I had to say that. She just passed recently.
I'm sorry to hear that. Sounds like a great lady.
Yes.
So I know that you, as Nikki Brown Clown, hosted some Kwanzaa events, and we're talking about holiday traditions today. So tell us a little about what Kwanzaa is and its origins and how you celebrate it.
Oh my gosh, Kwanzaa is absolutely one of my favorite things to do. I particularly learned about it from my father-in-law about 20 years ago. But honestly, Kwanzaa was started back in 1966 by Dr. Milana Kuranga. And he started that. He saw, similar to my mission, that somebody ought to do something, and saw that we didn't have anything for ourselves as Black people. And he started this African-American holiday, and he used the Swahili word Kwanzaa, which roughly translates first fruits. And then he just put it together, and he decided that because he didn't want to have it conflicting with a lot of us who were Christian at the time, it's non-religious, and he also didn't want folks to give up Christmas. He wanted to bring us together. And so to unite and self-reflect, especially after the riots in 1966.
Yeah. So how do you celebrate Kwanzaa?
Ooh, fun stuff. You know, first of all, there's two different ways that you can celebrate it. You can celebrate by attending local events in your community. It's celebrated all over the world at this point, believe it or not. Or you can celebrate it at home. By celebrating it at home, that means that you're going to need your kanara, which is a candle holder, similar to a menorah, I believe. But it holds 7 candles, and so you're going to want to order your candles. And you're going to need 3 red, 3 green, and 1 black. And you get your there's seven days that's going to be celebrated. It's going to start on December 26th. Intentionally, so it's the day after the Christmas, and then it's going to go 7 days off January 1st. So each day you're going to light a candle, okay? And so on the first day, you're going to light the black candle, and each day is assigned a principle, and each principle you're going to have a discussion. So it's not, you know, about gift giving, you know, similar to Christmas. That's why it's not a replacement. I mean, there are gifts that are given, but it's really about discussion and coming around the table. And I'm gonna be honest with you, it's about food. That's what we're talking about, the food, okay?
Speaking of food, can you tell us about the foods that you eat during Kwanzaa?
Yeah, so there really wasn't at first laid out any particular foods, but because it is an African-American holiday, most folks have decided to go ahead and go with traditional African-American foods, and some of us have even went back in because now with today we have beautiful African restaurants in our community that we can use to cater. So I know that for me, when I lived in Portland, I would want to get fresh collard greens or from a local black farmer. There's a farmer, a black farm-owned farm there in Portland called Mudbone Grown LLC. And you can get fresh greens and other things. So you could do like beans, stews, macaroni and cheese, fish. Oh, I'm getting hungry. You want to do like a cat, you know, like, you know, some people do a catfish. Myself, I'm going to do like a whiting. You can bake it or you could fry it. You could, or like in the past, those who have had the privilege to come or the opportunity, excuse me, not the privilege, the opportunity to attend one of my Kwanzaa celebrations, we've just used regular vendors, and usually we try to use a black-owned catering company. So you could do something fun and go with a food cart. Like a black-owned food cart, and you could have like desserts. So our friends at PDX Hannah's, he has snowballs, but I was thinking like maybe his Nana's banana pudding, twisted ice cream. So he has, and so like that's kind of a branch off of the traditional African American dessert, which is the banana pudding. Oh shoot!
What was that food cart called?
That's going to be PDX Hannah. You can find him on Facebook, Hannah's. I believe it's Hannah's. It's called Hannah's.
I'm sure people can find it.
Right. But we've also catered from Post Shine, which is right in the heart of the Kenton area of Portland. And they have like a New Orleans kind of Creole type food, Southern food. And so it's kind of fun to support, because Kwanzaa is about unity and supporting the black community, because that's what we became disenfranchised from our African roots or our culture, which is meaning getting together and creating collective income or economics. And so that's a good way. So I feel like if you're going to be buying something, maybe you don't want to buy a whole African Swahili outfit, but you could maybe buy some food and cater it, because who doesn't want to eat?
I do.
Okay.
So you mentioned that people get together and have discussions, and I think that there's 7 principles. Can you just kind of run us through those principles and like the kinds of discussions you might have?
Oh, of course. Okay, so the first night is going to be unity, which actually in Swahili we call it umoja, and that's we're going to have a discussion about helping each other. Then the second night is kuji chakalia, which means self-determination. And so we decide things for ourselves and whatnot. Then third day is going to be ujima. It's collective work and responsibility. And we work together to make our life better. Let's see, ujima, which means collective economics. We build and support our own businesses. So that's a good time. That's by the fourth day, you definitely should either create a market with black-owned vendors, maybe post something online about different black-owned businesses, or maybe just go and, you know, shop, even if it's just like, you know, earrings or a shirt or something like that. And then on the fifth day is Nia. I love this one because it means purpose. And in this, this is a time to kind of reflect and think what your purpose is going to be and why we're living. And then this is my favorite one, which works. By the sixth day, it's going to be the feast, and it is Kumba, and it means creativity. So on this day, you might want to do some arts and crafts. I love to do this. This is my fun part. You want to make handmade items and whatnot, but there's a feast. Everybody's going to get together. You're going to have like a potluck, or maybe not a potluck. Maybe you just have something at your house. Or if you're having a public event, you definitely want to have a feast. And during that time, there is a ceremony. It's a little different. You're going to have the elders come. And you're going to have the eldest person have a unity cup. That's part of your setup as well. And it's going to either have water, juice, or wine in it. And this cup is passed around. The elder asks for the blessings for the festival to happen. Okay, so it's going to call on the ancestors beforehand, and we're going to honor those who aren't here, so those who have passed. And then we will take a sip, that elder will take a sip and pass it around. Now, of course, you know, we in 2018, people don't usually pass around stuff. So if you're out in public, it'll probably be more like a communion communion style where everybody will just have their own cup. But if you're at home, it's just you, your husband, or your spouse, or whoever, you know, y'all can just share the cup. And then at the end, then you pour where, you know, you see people pour a little something out. So you pour some on the ground to honor those, the ancestors. And you say, you give them, so that libation. And then you kind of say, amen. And then on the seventh day, which it closes out, it's going to be January 1st, and that's Imani, and that's faith. Again, we're not talking about a religious thing. This is just simply we believe in ourselves, our ancestor. We have faith in the future. That's the seven ones.
It sounds awesome.
Yeah.
So I like that it's a not religious holiday. That sounds really cool. And it, you know, clearly rooted in the Black community. But are other people invited to celebrate Kwanzaa too, or is it like a?
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. In fact, when I had my last Kwanzaa event, I saw folks from Asian descent, Hawaiian people, because most of our families nowadays are made up. But this is a great time for you to go to the event as a non-African American, and you can show up. And this is a time for you not to, you know, talk, insert. You just go and enjoy and take it all in. And you can honor those ancestors, because at the end of the day, here, especially here in the United States, Black Americans are a great part of our ancestry. We're all, you know, it is part of U.S. history. So this is a great time for those of us to kind of pay, you know, give a safe, it's a time to give a safe space for Black Americans to do that, but for you to also to learn how to honor those in our community as well. And on top of it, it's a great time for you to you know, do a little research and shop with Black business, because we also need the support of non-Blacks as well to thrive in our community, especially in Portland. You can't just have just our own only folks shopping with us.
Very true. So obviously I don't know very much about Kwanzaa, and I think that, you know, a lot of people, you know, of all races don't know about Kwanzaa. Why do you think it's not, you know, as big as Christmas or Hanukkah or any of the other kind of major winter holidays?
Well, it really is, honestly, you know, it's in its infancy. It's 1966. I mean, I didn't get on this planet until 1973. So, I mean, you know, my mom was born in 1953. So she was still young in 1966 when it came on the scene. So it's really hard to kind of break those traditions. And a lot of folks, you know, feel like that there's this kind of thing when you see lighting of candles, people kind of go, ooh, wait a minute, I'm a little scared. Or maybe they feel like they hear the Swahili words. And it's a little intimidating at first. And so that's one of the main reasons why I set out to do maybe do it from the early childhood perspective and introduce early childhood books. And so at the last Kwanzaa event, I partnered up with Black Parent Initiative, and we sought out to give out at least over 100 My First Kwanzaa books to families that attended the celebration.
Very
so we
cool.
just had to start early.
That's great. Nikki, can you tell us about different places in Portland where people can come together to celebrate Kwanzaa?
Yeah, so right now, the place that I know of right now is going to be Maranatha. Maranatha Church is going to be on 4222 Northeast 12th Street. It's in the heart of Northeast Portland. And that celebration is going to start on Sunday, December 30th. And that's going to be Nia. And so that starts at 3:30. And there's going to be a discussion hosted. Let's see, who's it going to be hosted by? Let's see, December 30th at 3:30 at Maranatha. There's going to be food there, guys. It's going to be chili provided by Everybody Eats PDX. Yep, there's going to be different types of chili there. It's going to be an open discussion by Imam Mikhail Shabazz and another MSW doctor. I'm sorry, the name is slipping me right now, but sounds like that's the only celebration I know of at this time in Portland.
Awesome. Well, thanks for that. So I heard that you retired from being a clown. What are you doing now?
Oh my gosh, yes, I retired from being the clown. I got married back in 2016 to a nice man that I met while clowning at Sunday Parkways. And so now what I'm doing is what I'm doing is going on Facebook Live and educating. I still have my Nikki Brown Clown Library Facebook page where I'm constantly promoting events like the Kwanzaa
Cool. Well, thank you so much for joining us on the food show. Can you just give a couple shout outs for those places you said we could go buy food at? I don't remember already and I want to remember. So tell me where I can get food for Kwanzaa.
I would recommend that if you want to make your own food, go to the Mudbone Grown LLC, where you can get fresh greens and other vegetables. You can go to a food cart, Keys Loaded. There's also Hannah's, Snowballs, Post Shine, and Everybody Eats PDX.
Awesome.
Great, Nikki. Yeah. Thanks again for joining us today on the food show.
Thanks, guys.
Happy Kwanzaa.
Happy Kwanzaa. Happy Kwanzaa. Bye, guys. Okay.
Thank you. Thank you. You're listening to The Food Show. In studio today, we're joined by Johnny Shaver. Johnny organizes the Mauna Villa Emergency Warming Shelter with Portland Assembly and also works with the Sunnyside Warming Shelter. Johnny also works at the Oregon Food Bank and has been active in his neighborhood association for many years. Thanks for being here, Johnny.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit about the Mauna Villa Emergency Warming Shelter. How did you start it?
So it started 2 winters ago. It was right when Charlie Hale was leaving and Ted Wheeler was coming in, so I don't know who declared it, but one of them declared that with an incoming snowstorm, whoever could staff a warming shelter could have access to their community centers. So in about 36 hours, I got over 60 volunteers from my neighborhood to sign up. And so I presented that to the county, and they had a couple more restrictions that they gave us that I couldn't meet, and they were things like a paid security guard, which, you know, this was all volunteers, so I didn't have any money to do that. So I decided to contact St. Peter and Paul Episcopal Church in my neighborhood. I'd been volunteering at an organization that functions out of their church for several years called Rahab Sisters that serves vulnerable women. So I contacted the church. I told them I had the volunteers. They said, sure, have our space. And that was the first year. We were open for 4 nights. Last year, we were open for 24 nights, and we served over 600 guests.
So tell us about what makes an emergency shelter different from any of the other types of shelters.
Yeah, so we are bound to the county's severe weather protocol. So generally that's, let's see if I can remember this. Multnomah County has like a staggered definition of severe weather, but generally it's 25 degrees for more than 4 hours, and that's dry. And then anytime there's snow, that's going to stick. And then there's some wiggle room they have around if there's like a severe wind chill or there's going to be like a incredible amount of rain and cold weather. But those are pretty much the parameters.
So are you just constantly checking the weather all winter long, or do you get a call, or how's that work?
Both those things are true. So Montevilla is registered with 211. So anytime the county declares severe weather, 211 calls me as soon as that happens. But we are on call all winter. I try to forecast when we will probably need to be open and start doing like a shadow scheduling. But
what does that mean, shadow scheduling?
We create a schedule, and if we need it, we use it. And if we don't, then everyone's not working.
So it's like when you think the shelter will be open, and then you have volunteers that are available those days, and you kind of just put it. That sounds like a lot of organizing work.
It is a lot of work. It's definitely like a second full-time job that I have in the winters.
And it's all volunteer, right?
It is all volunteer. Yeah.
So the shelter right now is in a church.
Yeah.
What is, you know, when people show up, what's it like for them when they get there? Like, what's provided?
So one of the things that sets our shelter apart is that it's incredibly low barrier. You don't have to give us your real name, any name you want to be called. We need to know if you have a pet, and that is it. So right when you come in, you meet a desk, and there's a person that will check you in, give you a sack of supplies, toiletries, socks, hand warmers, that kind of stuff. And then you're free to go take your spot, whichever spot is best for you. And then we offer another thing that makes us unique is we have a promise to our guests, and that promise is a hot meal in the evening and a hot meal in the morning, food whenever you want it, and coffee all the time. So we have...
Can you tell us a little more about the food? And
yeah. So as you can imagine, we're open when everything else is closed. Food acquisition the first time was very easy. All my neighbors were like active. But last year we were open for 24 nights. So that's a little more to undertake than 4 nights. So my neighbors were still fantastic and very responsive. But we sort of tapped into some other sources. Free hot soup supplies us with some food they did last year, and it was a really great system. I think we'll probably tap into that again this year. And then, again, it's neighbor donations. And then we tapped into restaurants in our neighborhood. So East Gleason Pizza Lounge is a big, big supporter of the shelter. So every night we're open. At the end of their night, which is usually around 10 o'clock, we go get pizza from them. So that's been really great. So that's been our food acquisition so far. Right now, now that I work for the food bank, I feel like it's an insider perspective on how food systems work. So we will probably be able to access some stuff that way. Just resources that I didn't know we could tap into before that we can tap into. So,
do you all have a kitchen on site?
We do. We have a commercial kitchen. We have a commercial kitchen, a whole cafe area, and then a whole room for sleeping.
Fantastic.
Are people sleeping, or are they mostly just hanging out?
I would say it's about 2/3 sleeping and 1/3 hanging out, depending on what time of night it is, but there's always people hanging out in the cafe.
Mm-hmm. And then you have volunteers that are staying up all night, right?
Yeah.
And what is their job? What are they doing when they're there?
So that depends on the shift. We have an opening shift, and that's really like getting the place set up, making sure dinner's started and all the supplies are ready to go. And then the mid shifts are actually our most mellow time because people are sleeping or they're just sort of doing their own thing in the cafe. So a lot of that is just hanging out, being available to folks, making sure there's a safe ratio if anything were to happen. Yeah, so it's pretty easy. The morning shift is definitely always the hardest shift. Our agreement with the church is, you know, we are there from 7 to 7. So we have to kick people out into the snow in the morning. So that is no one's favorite thing. We make sure there's a really good hot breakfast every morning and that people know which day centers are still open. We've been, last year we really tried to get TriMet tickets. We'd like to do more of that this year. Yeah.
So that you can give people a ticket and say, here's where you can go for the day.
Right.
Cool. You mentioned that the Montevilla Emergency Warming Shelter is not part of the Multnomah County official warming shelter network and that it's different in some ways. Can you tell us a little bit about how it's different?
Sure. So I don't know if they include us in the network. They have started including me in county emails for the severe weather shelters. I know that right after I started, I was kind of a rogue because I didn't listen to their initial rules. So I know that was a little bit of a thing, but they've been really receptive to us since and very kind, and they have included me in these emails and their outreach calls. So I'm glad to have a good relationship with the county, but our actual functioning is different. We provide food, which is not a thing a lot of the emergency shelters are able to do, so that is definitely something that sets us apart, and we're independently functioning. There's no paid staff. It's all just my neighbors showing up when I ask them to, which is such a kindness that I can never repay them for.
Is there a reason why the other shelters don't offer food?
I think it's maybe logistics. I'm not sure. I know when we tried to take food to Imago Day last year, they didn't know what to do with it. They weren't set up to hand it out. So I don't actually know why. I guess I should volunteer at a TPI shelter, but I'm busy running this one, so.
That's understandable. Can you try to give us, like, what it's like, the perspective for the people you work with, like the houseless folks you work with during the holiday season?
Yeah. Well, it can be both an extreme time because of the weather. For folks who have been houseless for a while, sort of chronically houseless folks, who have been on the streets for some number of years, you create family on the street. And so it can, at the same time, be a really warm internal time, but it becomes exponentially harder to survive because of the cold and, well, in Portland, because of the rain. You can't get dry. If you can't get dry, you become susceptible to a lot of pretty dangerous things. So Portland is also, you know, we have a housing crisis, and I had a boss once make a joke that she would joke that I could solve anything. And so someone asked, like, well, maybe Johnny should just solve houselessness. And she was like, oh yeah, if he could do that, he'd be a millionaire. And I was like, no, I could do that. I just need to give people houses and you not have to worry about the profit. So capitalism is the thing here, but I guess that's the root of everything. So so winter is especially hard because people are having to survive the elements. That is additionally difficult because a lot of folks have suffered a lot of trauma over the years from being houseless, from being in shelters that were not low barrier and had a lot of rules and expectations, and just from having general mental health issues that came before being houseless or have been exacerbated by having to survive just the trauma of scarcity itself. So there's a lot of folks who prefer to be outside but aren't able to do that in the winter months. So that's when the shelter becomes important. Our goal is really just to keep all our neighbors alive. Did that answer the question? I think I went off on a tangent, but
I think it did. Okay. Absolutely. How can people get involved? How can people help? How can people volunteer?
Yeah, so we have a Facebook. It is the Montevilla Emergency Warming Shelter. There's also the Sunnyside Warming Shelter. Just go to the Facebook. We have volunteer signups. We just did 2 volunteer trainings. I think they are going really well. The trainings cover a whole lot of stuff. I know one thing that's different in our trainings is that TBI's training is a lot about the functioning of their shelter. Our training is a lot about how to exist with people and how to like treat them respectfully and hold our clients or our guests as sort of agents and experts of their own lives. So you can go to our Facebook pages. There's a Twitter that I've not been very active on, but it exists. And we just had a Radical Craft Fair. This year has been the first year we've had fundraisers. So that's been pretty exciting. We have an online fundraiser at mightycause.com. And that's, again, under Montevilla Emergency Warming Shelter. We call it Muse a lot because I'm easily amused. You can't see my finger guns. So those are the best ways to get involved. We've not been able to open because it hasn't been as cold this year. Mm-hmm. So we are also starting an outreach team so that when it is quite cold, but not cold enough to actually open, we can still get to folks and meet them where they're at.
What's your biggest need right now?
Our biggest need right now are blankets. I need 30 blankets that are ideally all the same.
So is it money to buy blankets that you need, or is it blankets?
I mean, if someone's able to donate a significant amount of blankets, I would love them. Money is also great. Like I said, the Mighty Cause fundraiser is a good way to donate money. We are working on becoming a nonprofit. So I have a tax ID.
Awesome.
Let's see if we can get those listeners out there today to donate those blankets.
So before the show, you mentioned that you work with your neighborhood association. Yeah. And you spend a lot of time trying to get your neighbors to recognize that houseless people are neighbors too. They're still neighbors. Like, how do you have those conversations? I need to have them with my neighbors too. I'm asking for advice.
Yeah, I'm afraid I don't have great advice. It didn't go super well. I was the chair of my neighborhood association for a single month. And in that month, I signed a resolution against sweeps. Now, neighborhood associations hold zero power, so it was just a suggestion that, you know, homeless sweeps are a bad idea.
Can you just, in case somebody doesn't know, what's a sweep?
Oh, a sweep is where they come into a camp and take everyone's belongings and shoo them away or arrest them.
Mm-hmm. Can I just to tie it to the food show, something that I'm really frustrated about is with sweeps is that people who are staying in a camp, you know, they'll go to a food pantry or they'll go somewhere and they'll acquire a bunch of food and then they lose all of that food in the sweep because it's not what they're going to take with them when they're told to move. And I think it's such a frustrating waste of everybody's resources where people just constantly are getting moved around.
Yeah, well, and a lot of pantries, because of how they're funded, require ID. And that is how most houseless people will lose their IDs being swept. So I wrote this resolution and then the neighbors got mad and about 150 neighbors wrote a resolution against it.
Yeah.
So I made a small portion of my neighbors mad, but I did, you know, I've got a warming shelter in my neighborhood that functions all on volunteer and support. So I feel like I'm doing okay.
That's fantastic.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, y'all. This is great.
Thanks, Johnny.
And that's it for this episode of The Food Show, our first episode of The Food Show together. If you missed any of the show or want to listen back, you can find the episode archive at the KBOO website at kboo.fm. We want to thank our guests, Jared Goodman, Nikki Brown, and Johnny Shaver for being on today's show. I also want to thank our engineer, Tammy. And stay with KBOO this afternoon, starting with Jazz Lives. And don't forget to tune in again next month on the third Wednesday of January for another episode of The Food Show. Until then, I'm Dahl Caspi.
And I'm Emily Becker. Thanks for listening.
From the radio station that brought you the Fall Drive thank you spot comes an on-air acknowledgement so controversial it will blow your mind.
On behalf of the entire KABU community, we'd like to offer our deepest and sincerest thanks for your contribution to KABU's holiday membership drive. Your support makes KABU possible. Thank you.
Oh, the humanity!
Our end-of-year fundraising campaign is still going on. Go to kboo.fm/give to donate right now.
Radio will never be the same again.
Support KABU, where music makes the movement.